B. Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, July 18th, 2019. Trump has done it again. He's found a new low. Leading a mob rally in North Carolina into a chant of "Send her back," aimed at Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. And while Trump is now gaslighting the episode, saying that, oh, he didn't want those chants and he was unhappy and he tried to cut them off, it's bullshit. He created the environment where a nearly all-white mob gathered to adore their, what is he? He's the stable genius. Well, he attacked Ilhan Omar. He questioned her loyalty to America. He called her anti-Semitic. And then the groups who were primed to chant "lock her up" after references to Hillary Clinton back in 2016, and that continues to this day, they chanted "send her back." Now, Omar is the only of the four members of the so-called squad who actually was born in a foreign nation. But she is a naturalized American citizen. She arrived here as a refugee at the age of 12. And she is the duly elected representative of a district in Minnesota. Well, that doesn't matter to Trump. He mischaracterized her. He lied about her, claiming that she hates Israel and hates the United States. It was a new low for ugly from a guy who specializes in ugly. And for him to try to distance himself today, asked by a reporter, he said, "I wasn't happy with it. I disagree with the chant." Asked why he didn't try to stop it, he said, well, he did by starting to speak again very quickly. But anybody who objectively looks at the videotape, you can see that Trump paused and basked in the repeated chants of "send her back." And his claim now, quote, "I felt a little badly about it. I didn't say that, they did." This is classic demagoguery. He organized a mob. He fed them red meat. And then he was shocked that they responded in the manner that anyone could have predicted. And so this is just another ugly day in modern America. And according to news accounts, the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee is already in the process of its race to the bottom, adopting Trump's gutter tactics, calling one Democratic, it's Lucy McBath, an Air Force combat veteran, a socialist loser, tagging people as anti-Semites. They're going to use a lot of name-calling. It doesn't have to be honest, factual, or in any way accurate for these Republicans. And Kevin McCarthy has described the key word for their messaging in 2020 as ruthless. And against this backdrop, the Democrats have used the angle of denunciation. And certainly, Trump deserves to be denounced. These are ugly comments, ugly tactics. And there are some Republicans who get a little queasy about it, even though they embrace the name-calling and the lack of honesty. Here's Mike Simpson of Idaho, Congressman. "I wish we'd get off that and start talking about the economy and things that are really good, things that majority of Republicans agree with. It's okay to say, hey, these guys are promoting a socialist agenda, but when you call them un-American, when you get personal in that kind of stuff, I think you cross the board." I think he meant to say cross the line. At any rate, the Republicans do recognize that this could be expensive for them in terms of support in 2020. But many of them are hunkering down and hoping that this unabashed appeal to racism, hate, and division will get them where they want to go, which is back into the majority. Now, AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, said that Trump is evolving, as predicted, deeper into the rhetoric of racism, which evolves into violence. I think it's natural to be concerned with safety. And Justin Amash, who was a Tea Party guy, and I certainly don't agree with much of his political positioning, but he's the guy who left the Republican Party on July 4th, now an independent, and he said, quote, "A chant like 'send her back' is ugly and dangerous, and it's the inevitable consequence of President Trump's demagoguery. This is how history's worst episodes begin. We must not allow this man to take us to such a place." And Bernie Sanders, quick to denounce it, saying that Trump is stoking the most despicable, disturbing currents in our society, called him the most dangerous president in the history of our country. Senator from California and presidential candidate Kamala Harris said the behavior is vile, cowardly, racist. Elizabeth Warren, also a candidate, he's trying to divide us and distract us from his own crimes, from his deeply unpopular agenda of letting the wealthy and well-connected rip off the country. We must do more. And Ilhan Omar cited a poem by Maya Angelou, quote, "You may shoot me with your words, you may cut me with your eyes, you may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise." She later posted, "I am where I belong," a reference to "send her back," "at the people's house, and you're just gonna have to deal." And to her credit, Ilhan Omar is not being diverted by this, and yesterday she introduced a resolution affirming the use of boycotts as constitutionally protected free speech. Now, while the resolution does not mention Israel, it does not mention boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which I support and which many politicians, including most Democrats, want to deny me, is that I have a right to steer my dollars away from a government that I don't approve of. The resolution affirms that all Americans have the right to participate in boycotts in pursuit of civil and human rights at home and abroad. It opposes unconstitutional legislative efforts to limit the use of boycotts to further civil rights at home and abroad. And it urges Congress, states, and civil rights leaders from all communities to endeavor to preserve the freedom of advocacy for all by opposing anti-boycott resolutions and legislation. Now, she drew two co-sponsors, predictably, the Congresswoman from Detroit, Rashida Tlaib, but surprisingly, John Lewis of Georgia. Now, Lewis is a veteran of the civil rights era, a man I have a lot of respect for, but he is caught. He is a deep supporter of Israel, and he is also a co-sponsor of H.R. 246, a different bill, which is attempting to limit participation in boycotts aimed at the state of Israel. So I don't think this is schizophrenic on Lewis's part, but it is novel to support these two conflicting pieces of legislation. So I want to mention before I dive into this next part that last night I was curious to watch Rachel Maddow's show on MSDNC, and she set up the show saying that Trump's attacks on the squad are, in her view, likely attempting to distract us from other issues. Now, that's a worthy theory, but she proceeded to spend the whole hour of her program repetitiously describing two events that occurred today and suggesting that Trump wanted to distract us from them. One is that yesterday a court in New York City in Manhattan revealed that the case investigating the campaign finance violations and the hush money deals that were put together by Mike Cohen, that those cases, that investigation, is coming to an end. And it signals that there won't be any additional indictments. And I believe that Trump himself should be, at least at minimum, an unindicted co-conspirator. And I believe that people who enabled it, like David Pecker at the National Enquirer, like Hope Hicks, who we now know was directly involved in the conversations to pay off Stormy Daniels. Well, why are they not being pursued, even into a plea deal with no penalty? I cannot explain it. And it appears that the investigation may have been truncated, perhaps by the latest Attorney General, Bill Barr. I want to be clear, I don't know. I am simply asking questions. But the court filing unsealed today said that Trump and Hope Hicks spoke repeatedly with Cohen in October of 2016 following the release of the pussy-grabbing tape, and they decided they need to button up some of Don's girls. Trump and Hicks had a four-minute call with Cohen on the evening of October 8th of 2016. That was the day after the pussy-grabbing tape was released. Immediately, Cohen embarked on a flurry of calls and texts with the folks at the National Enquirer, and they ended up holding the bag because Trump never reimbursed them for the payoff to the former Playboy playmate Karen McDougal, who has said that she had an affair with Trump. So this is puzzling. And I still maintain, and we'll get to the issue of impeachment in a moment, that Trump is immediately impeachable based on Cohen's plea deal and what we already know, and there's more evidence coming out now, about Trump's direct involvement in this corrupt enterprise that was an effort to enhance his electoral prospects by keeping bad dirt from surfacing before the election. So the other case that Rachel Maddow supposes Trump is trying to distract us from was the hearing today where Jeffrey Epstein, the millionaire, we don't think he's a billionaire, who is a sex offender, a registered sex offender, despite the sweetheart deal that he got in Florida in 2008, he has been denied bail. And that doesn't surprise me at all. I don't think he had any chance of having his plan to be locked up at his mansion in New York City with armed guards that he would pay for. I never expected that the judge would approve that, and he referred to the plan proposed by Epstein's lawyers as irretrievably inadequate, and that any bail package he doubted could overcome the risk of danger to the community. So this puts in motion a plan, a sequence of events where Epstein will be tried and a lot of information will go public. And what was fascinating about Rachel Maddow's coverage is that she only links Jeffrey Epstein to Donald Trump. And they trotted out old footage of Trump and Epstein ogling girls, and Trump even grabbed the butt of a girl who was partying with him. No mention of Bill Clinton, who was a pal of Epstein's for 15 years, took many flights on the Lolita Express to Epstein's private island in the Virgin Islands, always accompanied by young girls. And Vicky Ward, who tried to report Jeffrey Epstein's criminality as early as 2003, is one of the people who's reported that Alex Acosta, who resigned last week as the Labor Secretary, embarrassed by the plea deal that he orchestrated with Epstein back in 2008. Well, Epstein, according to Acosta in comments to the Trump transition team, belonged to intelligence. So we know that he was involved in a relationship with Ghislaine Maxwell, and that after what we're told was a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, she kind of became his house manager and is accused of arranging many of his contacts with underage girls for massage that included the so-called happy ending, happy for Epstein anyway. And we know that the Attorney General Barr has recused himself because Epstein got his start as a math teacher when Barr's father, Donald Barr, was the headmaster of the elite Dalton School in New York City. And I've got a background report here from the Institute for Public Accuracy that I'm citing. Julie K. Brown of the Miami Herald has named two women, Virginia Roberts Jeffrey and Sarah Ransom, who say that Epstein directed them to have sex with Alan Dershowitz, an attorney and a well-known Harvard law professor who is implicated in this case. But that doesn't draw a mention from Rachel Maddow or from most elements of the corporate media. And I believe that the Epstein case here has the potential to certainly involve Bill Clinton, if not others, including Prince Andrew and other people who hung out with him. And part of the speculation here, which is advanced by a lengthy report, the first of two parts, at Mint Press News today under the byline of Whitney Webb. And as you know, I have a lot of regard for Whitney Webb's investigative work. Well, she suggests, based on a lot of history, that Epstein's links and his involvement in a sophisticated, well-funded sexual blackmail operation have spurred just few media outlets to examine the history of intelligence agencies, both in the U.S. and abroad, conducting similar sexual blackmail operations, many of which also involved underage prostitutes. So I haven't had time to read her entire report. I printed it out. It runs about 30 pages. I will have further comment on it tomorrow when I've had a chance to digest it further. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Susan Gavet, Carl Howard in Columbus, Ohio, Cliff Johnson, and my buddy Jim Garrison. They each kick in sometimes $20 a month, and they support my work. I'd like you to do it, too. All you have to do is visit peterbcollins.com, click on Menu, click on Become a Subscriber, and you land on the sign-up page where you can make an easy choice of the level of subscription that's comfortable for you. And if you choose the $50 annual, I will reward you with a bonus book, currently offering 2001, the book that is a blueprint for survival under climate change. And I'd love to send you a copy of that with your new annual subscription and a mailing address in the continental U.S. I want to take a couple of minutes here to quote liberally from an essay that was sent to me by Michael Brenner earlier today. Brenner is a professor of international relations at the University of Pittsburgh. He doesn't have a blog, so I have made a copy of this and included it in the show file for today's podcast. It has not been published, to my knowledge, in any online outlet. So he writes about his thoughts that the Jeffrey Epstein scandal reveals turpitude and moral squalor, and that it could connect to two occupants of the White House. He's referring to Trump and Clinton. And then the Trump proclamation of his deep-seated racism and fascistic instincts in his heinous assault on elected representatives. And he says, the United States as a society has degraded itself, a process deepened and facilitated by its elites. Epstein was a fixture in that world of celebrity, a caste which encompasses persons from all spheres of the privileged. The AOC affair was triggered by Nancy Pelosi in her interview with Maureen Dowd in the New York Times, in which she yielded to petty vanity and envy in a bout of catty nastiness reminiscent of the orangutan himself. The response to Trump's Twitter storm is not adequate, a few boilerplate words about diversity being America's strength notwithstanding. And I'll also point out here that Pelosi helped create this opening, number one, by a few months ago, allowing that resolution that was a veiled pushback on Ilhan Omar claiming that she had been anti-Semitic in her tweet about the Benjamins. And the failure of Democrats to properly defend Omar at that time is costing them plenty today. So continuing with Brenner's commentary, on Wednesday last week, Pelosi mobilized her forces within the Democratic caucus. She was in full Maureen Dowd mode, denouncing the squad as a threat to Democratic unity. She scolded them for criticizing other Democrats, as she had done to them just days before. She disparaged their electoral victories in constituents and mocked them for thinking that 4 million Twitter followers means anything. At the end of the meeting, Pelosi sought to heal the wounds she had freshly reopened, asked a preacher to come forward, but there wasn't one. And, he goes on, whereas the GOP doesn't hesitate to cosset neo-Nazis and white supremacists, the Dems feel the need to publicly denounce elected representatives who are simply New Dealers and immigration activists. The inability of the party establishment to recognize this dramatic evidence of a generation-long political failure explains much about the state of the Democratic Party and the state of the country. Then, in a new section, he writes about political suicide. It's an ugly business, and that's especially true when it's an act of an entire party, the one which you have always sympathized with. The Democrats don't even do us the courtesy of ending it all with a swift, clean stroke. Decisive action remains alien to them, even at the finish line. They dither and drag it out for decades. Then he goes on, this theater of the absurd pretty much sums up our dilemma. The country is being run and run into the ground by a clinical psychopath who leads a cult of neo-fascists. They dominate the public discourse. Together, they already have deformed American political and economic institutions in ways that are likely to endure. We officially engage in mass kidnapping and abuse of children. Our celebrity elites number among consorts of Jeffrey Epstein, whose heinous crimes they participate in, as well as cover up. There's a good chance that two men who've held the highest office in the land are among them. Yet amidst all this, we are offered the spectacle of the threadbare Democratic establishment invoking God to stuff a rag in the mouth of the few who speak the truth and urge that we act on it. I think those are powerful words from Professor Brenner. There is more in this piece. I hope I've given you a taste of it. But he also notes this. Let me pull one more quote. If the squad were really after Pelosi's skin, they would employ far more drastic methods. There's a lot of heavy artillery at their disposal. Remember that Pelosi has been an ardent backer of the war on terror in all its manifestations ever since 2001. She never has criticized the huge costs of Iraq and Afghanistan. She asked no questions about our continued military presence there and in 68 other countries. It took her 3 years to utter a peep against the U.S. participation in the slaughter in Yemen. Furthermore, her record on civil liberties is just as dismal. So I encourage you to read this piece. And I think that he successfully ties together many of the threads that bring us to this very ugly moment in American politics and rhetoric. And yesterday, as I predicted, I didn't know how, but I knew Pelosi was going to kill Congressman Al Green's resolution to impeach Trump. And she used the resolution to table it instead of referring it to committee. So it is dead by a vote of 332 to 95. Wow. 137 of the 235 House Democrats voted against this procedural vote. A majority didn't even want to consider it. And so the denunciation, all of this anguish that Democrats project after being attacked by Trump, it's really meaningless and irrelevant because they will not use the constitutional remedy that's available to them. And over at The Intercept today, Ryan Grimm reports on a progressive caucus meeting that was attended, that's the House Progressive Caucus, by Senator Chuck Schumer, who is the Democratic leader in the Senate. And the underlying trigger for this whole schism that led Pelosi to criticize the squad was the immigration bill. It's a border bill that came over from the Senate. And Schumer said he truly didn't expect the House to pass the Senate bill unamended. And he was surprised when Pelosi threw in the towel. Now, Pelosi's spokesperson, Drew Hamill, he says, well, we were just as hopeful as Senate Democrats that McConnell would honor our wishes to hold a conference to get a stronger bill. But they didn't even take a moment to attempt it. They just accepted the Senate version and passed it through the House. something is rotten. Very rotten. Inside the core of the Democratic establishment. Now to the good news. Today, the House passed by 231 to 199 a bill that will raise the minimum wage gradually over the next 6 years up to $15. But the Blue Dogs and the Conservadems inserted clauses that require a study to see if it is causing job displacement after the minimum wage reaches $9.50. So it may never get to $15, but that's what they're doing in the House. And this could lead to some incremental improvement, but the Senate is not going to favor this bill. It will only pass if they're able to attach it to some piece of legislation that Mitch McConnell can't afford to table and to block. And so the prospects are limited that it will actually be enacted into law. Today is a new low for BuzzFeed News. I've always felt that they were cozying up to the establishment, trying to be young and publishing all those celebrity listicles to attract a younger audience. And this seals it for me. Listen to this headline. Lawmakers want the Pentagon to investigate a bizarre conspiracy theory that the government weaponized ticks and spread Lyme disease. Now, there's a new book out that I read while I was on vacation. It's called Bitten, and it's written by Chris Newby, who contracted Lyme disease, couldn't find a way out, and she's published a book that suggests that Lyme disease was either an intentional or unintentional release from the bioweapons operations of the United States that took place at Fort Detrick and elsewhere. It's an interesting book. It doesn't come to a clear conclusion. But Chris Smith, a Republican from New Jersey, I almost called him a Democrat. I thought he was. But he attached an amendment authorizing the investigation into possible involvement of the Department of Defense biowarfare labs in the weaponization of Lyme disease in ticks and other insects. This is a very credible theory. And we know from the reporting of Jeffrey Kay that I've distributed on this podcast that during the Korean War, we used fleas that had been infected intentionally with bubonic plague that were released in several instances in Korea. And so the idea that this is some massive conspiracy theory is flat-out bullshit. And it shows that BuzzFeed is running interference for the deep state. And I acknowledge that we need more evidence to prove these things. But there's enough evidence to declare that this is not some sort of a bizarre conspiracy theory. And I want to thank our friend Natalie Reel, who's in Montana, who is a Lyme disease carrier. And she has shared some of this information on this new legislation with me over the last couple of days. Want to recommend that you visit andyworthington.co.uk. He is the journalist who has devoted his life to exposing the evils of Guantanamo and our rendition and incarceration programs. Also, at today's New York Times, we see an interesting photo essay put together by Carol Rosenberg. She covered Guantanamo for the Miami Herald for many years and now is indirectly reporting for the New York Times. I want to recommend that you visit both. The pictures are worth seeing. And what Andy reports on is the new report that came out from a group that is, let's see what they're called, the Rendition Project. And I want to credit Sam Raphael, Ruth Blakely, and Crofton Black. They spent 4 or 5 years essentially unredacting the redacted CIA torture report that was partly released by the Senate in 2014. And they were able to piece together the identities of almost 100 people who were tortured or detained by the CIA. 39 of them were subjected to the enhanced interrogation techniques, and about 100 of them were subjected to lengthy detention by the United States. At least 26 of the 119 were wrongfully held and did not meet the Bush administration's own standards for being held. Also, I'm pleased to report that my concerns about the misuse of DNA genealogy, you know, 23andMe and these other services that people use to try to find out who their ancestors were, I object to the misuse of that data in criminal investigations. And I bristled when the so-called suspect in the Golden State Killer crime spree here in California was tagged using DNA collected from his garbage and matched to samples that were found online. And the investigators used some questionable tactics to establish the linkage that they did. Well, yesterday, this same process was used to exonerate a man named Christopher Tapp, who was convicted in 1997 of the murder and rape of 18-year-old Angie Dodge. He spent 20 years behind bars on a false conviction, and he was released and cleared of the rape back in 2017 by the Idaho Innocence Project, but until this week, he was not fully exonerated because using a 23-year-old degraded DNA sample, they found the man behind the brutal killing, Brian Lee Drips, who once lived on the same street as the victim, had confessed to the killing, and his DNA matched the original profile of the suspected killer. One more item as I wrap up today. I spent 3 weeks in Europe, in France and Italy and Croatia, and one of the negatives was people there are still smoking a lot of cigarettes. And you go to a restaurant and people are lighting up throughout the entire meal. There are no segregated areas for smokers. And so I found it really annoying. The other thing that is surprising at is that this rate of smoking continues, despite the fact that in the European Union, cigarette packages have a modest logo of the brand, like Lucky Strike or Marlboro. The rest of the package is devoted to really grisly pictures of cancer victims. And you see those lying around on a cocktail table or, you know, in somebody's belongings. And you wonder if they ever look at those pictures and if it ever causes them to think that maybe they ought to quit smoking. I hope it works for some people. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You can share it with absolutely everybody. It's on YouTube, and I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.